agenda es un poco extraña, no es el tradicional taller en el que se cuentan las ponencias correspondientes. Yo tengo aquí copias de las actas que he preparado con los papers que se han presentado en el se han mandado al taller. La agenda va a ser, en primer lugar, Jan Furgens, yo lo presentaré, va a dar una charla invitada de 2 horas con un intermedio de 10 minutos. Después tendremos el café, a continuación una reunión de trabajo, porque como sabéis, esta actividad se enmarca dentro de las actividades de la red temática de seguridad en tecnología de la información, la red Redistic. Por lo tanto, a partir de las 11:30 haremos la entrega de documentación correspondiente a la red, haremos la presentación de los trabajos que intervenimos en esta red y, bueno, intentaremos planificar el futuro de la red. Por tanto, como sabéis, nos van a hacer unas presentaciones rigurosas de los papers que se han mandado al taller. Y sin más dilación, I would like to introduce you Jan Furgens, Professor of Tourism. He is one of the main researchers in the field of security in UML, and he is the main researcher in UMLSEC. So, I'm going to speak about UMLSEC, and I would like that you find interesting this presentation. So, please.
Yeah, thank you very much for the introduction, and thank you very much for the opportunity to give this presentation here. I would like to give an introduction into using UMLSEC, which is an extension for UML for secure systems development in the context of security critical systems. Just firstly, some personal background. So I'm working at the Technical University of Munich in the area of security and software engineering, and we are having quite a lot of collaboration there with industrial partners, and I will also explain a little bit about the collaboration there. Firstly, some general introduction. So I think everyone will be aware now today that computer security is really a problem. So our today's computer networks and complete societies really depend on computer networks, and these networks are really quite insecure. And you can notice that if you listen to the news almost any day, there are news about viruses being spread or a new hole in software being detected, or maybe websites hacked and so on. So security is really a problem. And it's not really just about losing credit card numbers or having a website defaced or things like that, but it's really a big problem. So one example, a couple of years ago, a couple of hackers from the National Security Agency in the US demonstrated that they would have been able to break into the computers of the Department of Defense in the US and also in the electric power grid system, and would have been able to bring down the computers and the power grid system, and also to bring down the emergency network call system in Washington, D.C. So you can really make some real damage today, because all of these critical infrastructures now depend on computing networks, and they are also in many cases somehow linked to the internet, and therefore they are relatively easy to attack. So that's the general background. That's the example which I just gave. So as I just mentioned, there are many problems in computing systems and in software being detected almost any day. So the question is, what are the causes for this kind of problem? So firstly, the problem is that security is just a difficult topic. And the reason for that is, if you want to design a software system which is supposed to be secure, then you have to worry about adversaries that are determined to attack your system. So this is different from for example, from safety critical systems. So if you want to build software for an airplane or a car, then of course you also have to be very careful, because if the software breaks down, then a human life may be threatened and so on. So there you also have to be careful, but security is somehow more difficult, because in safety critical software you usually only worry about accidental problems. So hardware may fail with a certain probability, and you have to somehow cope with that by using fault tolerance mechanisms and so on. But in security it's quite a different situation, because you have to assume that there's a human who really wants to attack the system. So it's not accidental, but it's really by malicious intent. And that's a much different problem, because now in security you really have to worry about everything. In a safety critical system you just have to say, okay, everything has to be more or less safe, and then the whole thing will be safe. But in security, if there's just one little flaw, one little security hole somewhere, then the adversary will find it. I mean, assuming that there's enough motivation and there's an adversary who has the knowledge to attack the system, then if there's only one flaw, then it will be found. And it's really, it's really difficult, because you have to design a system which runs in an environment which is under the control, in many cases, of the adversary. So this is an example of a security protocol which was developed by two of the leading experts in the field when it was really starting, the field of security protocols, in the late 70s. And it turned out that there were attacks found against that security protocol a long time after they designed it. So the last couple of problems were detected 17 years later. And these were really the experts in the field who designed that. And the problem is that an example of a security protocol is it's a very good example for a security critical system in that sense, because here the goal of a security protocol is to set up a secure communication channel over an insecure communication link, such as the internet. And in reality, you have to assume that the adversary can really have complete control over the communication which is exchanged over the internet link. So this means that the adversary completely controls the communication, but you still want to set up a secure communication link. And that's very difficult. I mean, there are of course mechanisms for that, cryptographic algorithms to encrypt data and so on, but just to set up the secure channel to start with is very difficult, and this is one example for that. And so the second kind of example, the first reason is simply security is very difficult. Then secondly, okay, even if you assume that you have security experts who design mechanisms such as cryptography or such as cryptographic protocols and so on, then you still have to use these mechanisms in the context of your overall system. So the question is, you then have to be able to securely include the mechanisms in your system. And that's the second kind of problem. So this is supposed to be exemplified by this picture here. You can see that there's a road which is blocked by this bar, because no car is supposed to go through the road. And this is a classic example of a secure mechanism, because as you can see, the bar is intact, it's not broken or anything, so we assume it's secure. Unfortunately, as you can also see, it's not securely integrated in the environment of the system, because as you can see, the people simply drove around the bar on the grass and therefore could still go through the street. And that's, it's a fun example if you just look at the picture like that, but it's really the situation for many software systems. You have secure mechanisms such as cryptography or so, but it's very difficult to use them correctly in the system context, so that no one could circumvent the mechanisms. And so this is what one expert, which we saw on the previous slide already, said when he said this, that it's not enough just to use cryptography somehow and then assume that everything will be fine, but you have to use it correctly. And this is also something which you can often see on e-commerce website, so they tell you on the website if you want to buy something, buy a book or DVDs or whatever on the internet, and you have to send them your credit card number to pay. They usually tell you something like, you can trust us, this is secure, because we use SSL to encrypt the communication. Which is of course good that they do that, but it's not sufficient. I mean, it's comparable to if they, you know, if the system here, the people would say, okay, the street is secure because we have a bar in the middle. So it's good, but it's not always enough. And that's the situation at the moment. So in the case of this example using SSL, it can still be the case that hackers break into the back-end office, the databases, although the communication between the client and the server is encrypted by an SSL connection. I mean, there can be many other ways of getting into the system. So it's really non-trivial. And if you cannot just say, okay, we have the security mechanisms such as SSL, and we can just use them, and then everything will be fine. So it's not as trivial as that. So this is, I'm trying to show this with this picture. So we have secure mechanisms such as this lock here, but the overall computing systems or the software systems today are not robust. So it's easy to break in anyway. You don't have to open the lock, you just break into the system just like that. And I mean, one classic example for that is popular operating systems, and you can notice that every day almost you get new patches, and this is actually what has been the main strategy over the last couple of years or decades even for commercial software, that people who design the software often don't worry too much about security to start with. So they just write the software as quickly as possible and as cheaply as possible. Then they sell the software to the customer. And then later, if a problem arises, they will write a patch, and the patch will be distributed, and so on. I mean, this is the current situation, and everyone knows that who uses this kind of software. This is almost everyone. And well, you could also call this the banana strategy, because you could say this is like selling a green banana to your customer and letting it ripen at the customer. So that's what's being done today with software. You sell the software, although it's not really completely 100% done. It doesn't work, but it's not secure. And if it's already at the customer, you still have to do to write patches for the security holes that will come up and then distribute them, which is of course not good for two reasons at least, because firstly, the problem is, the question is who finds the flaws in the first place? Will this be an honest hacker who does this for fun and for fame maybe, and then sells it immediately to the software engineer so they can patch it? Or maybe it is like an evil cracker who wants to exploit this and make money out of that. And in the second case, you may really have a problem. And then secondly also, it's not really a nice task to all the time have to update patches, and it's really quite disruptive. And you actually lose quite a lot of customer trust with that. So it's not a good situation, and this is also what many companies are realizing today now. Such as Microsoft, for example, they are now starting to really put a lot of money into security. But the problem is, of course, over the last 20 years or so, it just used to be the commercially most successful strategy to not worry about security. Because until maybe 5 or 10 years ago, security was not such an issue anyway in civil systems. I mean, it was always an issue in military systems, but until 10 years ago, no one used the internet for commercial purposes, for example. So this really has changed over the last 5 or 10 years, and it takes a lot of time, of course, to improve the existing software systems, and hopefully also to improve the new software. And of course, people have been realizing this for quite a lot of time now. I mean, researchers in security at universities know about the problems for 20 years, I would say, since like the buffer overflow attacks, which like, you know, you can see every week or so a new one is detected. People in principle know that, but the problem is much of a lot of academic research has concentrated on solutions which are very interesting from a research point of view, but which are not always easy to use in practice. And this is a lot of been done has been done in the area of formal methods, like using logic-based or mathematics-based methods to reason about specifications, or maybe even try to formally verify source code in order to make sure that the code is secure. Actually, there has been a lot of research done, but the problem is that it's rather expensive to use in practice. Firstly, you have to train people into being able to use logic and to use mathematics in order to verify the systems, and you may also have to specifically construct formal specifications which you then verify, and all of that is a lot of effort in many cases. So that's why they're not actually being used so much in industry, although in principle, from the research point of view, they are quite interesting actually. And that's sort of the starting point for this kind of research. So on the one hand, we would like make use of the research that has been done in the formal methods area, but we would like to transport this to practice and try to integrate it in the software engineering context. And if you want to do that, you will always have to worry about keeping the investment that companies have to make in time and in money to keep that bounded. And so the idea is now to start with artifacts, so with data or with constructions, with specifications and so on, to start with these kind of things which are present already in the industrial development and use of software. So, and this could be different things, starting with the development phase of software. Today, increasingly, specifications are being used, for example, using UML models, and that you can try to use to analyze the design for security flaws. Then the second thing you could also try to do is to analyze the implemented source code, and then maybe also analyze configuration data, or maybe things like database contents, and try to also use automated tools to analyze that for security weaknesses. And that's the second goal here is to use tool support. So because in practice, people cannot be expected to make this kind of security analysis in a manual way because it's rather time consuming. So you need tool support which is efficient and automated, so as little interaction with the software engineer as possible. And from the research point of view, of course, it would also be nice if it's theoretically sound in the sense that you can say, if the tool says that the system is secure, then it is secure in a well-defined way. It will never be 100% secure, because that's really not not possible, because you would have to worry about, you know, even go down to the physical level and worry about people trying to attack the systems in a physical way, which is not feasible in this kind of approach. But the goal is to be really precise about what kind of security guarantees you can get using this kind of approach. And the overall label or the slogan you could call this is sort of model-based security engineering. And this is sort of inspired by the more general model-based software development, which is sometimes in the UML community called model-driven architecture, which is a different name, but it's really the same kind of idea. And now a guide to security here. If you now concentrate on the on the software development and not so much on the use of the software but the development, then the idea here would be that you firstly have to establish the requirements which we have on the system, and here in particular you have to establish which kind of security requirements should be fulfilled. Then you construct models which give the specification of the system, for example UML models which may specify the design of the functionality of the system, and you should then be able to analyze the model with respect to the requirements. And again, as far as possible, using automation tool support. And then, of course, what you want in the end is the code, which is then going to be executed. And for that, you can either use code generation, which works in some cases, but not always. And if it doesn't work, you can still write the code manually and then use test sequence generation to establish that the code actually does what the model specifies. And you can actually also go in the reverse direction if you have the code, then try to extract models from the code in order to also again analyze them. So you can also try to apply this kind of approach to legacy systems, so to systems which exist already, and from which you then extract the models in order to analyze them with respect to the requirements. Yes.
In the field of action between your research and the modern security
and the security field? Yes, it's a similar kind of approach in general. We have not really made a formal link yet, but so as I should compare that, the secure UML approach by David Levin and others, the difference is that at least so far, as far as I'm aware, they concentrate mainly on access control. The work also aims to have this kind of connection between specifications and code. So actually this is, from the beginning, I think this was what their main initial focus was. Whereas the kind of work on UML initially you only worried about the specification level. So they were more specific in the sense that they only considered access control, but they went down deeper in the sense that they had this connection from the beginning. And UMLSEC is more in a horizontal place. You can have more different kinds of security requirements and aspects, but in the beginning at least it was only in the specification level. But now we're also going down in a vertical way into the source code.
And have you considered transformation between the models of different types?
Yes, yeah. I mean, I can also say a little bit about that if we have some time at the end. So I have a couple of slides in there which is actually not included in this set, but I can just look them after at the end. So we did some kind of under the slogan of security patterns. So a pattern is a general idea, design patterns by a couple of people, Gamma and others. There were a couple of books in the late 90s with the idea to apply established solutions from software engineering experts in the software engineering development process. And you can also try to apply this in security. There's also been some work on that. For example, at Paradesk, I think Louis is also working on that, and that's sort of what we're also trying to do there in the context of UMLSEC to also make use of these ideas. I can show a little bit more about that later. So transformations are generally important. So either from one model to another, like an abstract model to a more concrete model, or then later to the code. So that's quite a central idea, transformations more generally in model-based software engineering. So you have transformations everywhere and all the time. And the goal is in principle that it would be good if you could sort of consider if you really had a way back and forth between the models and the code, because if you can only go one way down, then the problem is that that's not the way it works in practice, because usually if you do this, then if you already have the code, then in many cases, the customer will suddenly realize that in fact they want to a different system, right? And as that was usually happening in practice, you define the requirements, you may write specifications, and then you get to the code somehow, and then suddenly the customer looks at the code and looks at the system instead and says, but I want something else, you know. That's reality, unfortunately. And therefore it's important that you can go back to that point and then go back to the models and change the models and go back to the code and so on. Okay, now this kind of approach could in principle follow with any kind of mutation which supports this model-based development. Now, okay, why UML? So I'm using UML as a notation at least in this presentation because I need to use some kind of notation. In principle, you could also use a different notation. It's not really so specific what I'm going to explain here to UML. But I mean, there are certain advantages also for UML because they are used by so many people, and this is really still increasing because a lot of people at universities are learning UML still. So this is given the kind of the first mutation of this kind which has so many users and is still relatively precisely defined. So, meaning that it's not formally precise in a logic-based or mathematical way, but it's defined precisely in using English language. And there are already quite a few tools which are in development for that. So that's why you could want to use UML. Now, what is the idea of UML 6 and more specifically? The goal is to define an extension of the UML notation for the development of security closed systems with several goals in mind. So firstly, we want to be able to evaluate UML specifications for possible security weaknesses in the design. So that's the one thing. And then the second thing, so this is the sort of analysis part, then you also want to have a more synthetic approach in this context, namely you want to be able to use established rules of prudent security engineering in the context of this approach as a sort of objective. So that way you would be able to make this approach available to people who are not specialized in security themselves. And while it's important to consider security requirements from early on in the system development, and as a side effect, if you aim to have your system certified, if it's really highly critical, then you can actually use this kind of documentation, the UML models, in order to use this in the certification process. So now the question is, how is this going to work exactly? So the first important thing to realize here is that many security requirements can actually be defined and formalized universally, independently from the system that you actually want to develop. So you don't have to do this every time again, that if you develop a new system, then you can still use the same kind of definitions which you defined once and for all, like secrecy, that your data is supposed to remain secret, or integrity, meaning the data is not supposed to be modified. You can define this once and for all and use it every time again you develop a new system. And this is very important for this kind of approach, because this allows us as the developers of this kind of approach to define security requirements once and for all as so-called stereotypes in the UML context, and I will explain exactly what this means. And then the engineers can just use the stereotypes, which are the labels, which they can stick into the UML models, and they don't have to worry about the formal definitions of the security requirements.
So you focus your attention on confidentiality and integrity?
Not only that. So confidentiality, integrity, then authenticity, meaning that data, you should be able to make sure that a message comes from a source which you believe that the message comes from, and then So would other like things like more specialized things like back chain properties, which means that if you have an electronic transaction, then this back exchange means that none of the transaction partners is able to cheat the other partner, and so on. So in principle, the aim eventually is to be able to cover all kinds of security requirements, and not only secrecy and confidentiality. I mean, many scandals go about secrecy, for example, but this is mainly because this is the security requirement which is most easy to understand, but it would also work with the other requirements. Yes, that's important that you always have these security requirements are always, you have to formulate them relative to a certain adversary. And this may be an external adversary, but it may actually be a user of the system. So the user of the system may be allowed to do certain things or to know certain data, but not to know other data or to do other things. So the first thing is important to realize that system users may actually be adversaries, so they could be called internal adversaries. And therefore, as you point out, it's important to make precise which kind of adversary you worry about. And I will explain this in more detail how this works. So you can define adversary models, and this could be, for example, internal or external adversary, and then the security analysis is performed relative to a given adversary model. And that way you can do that, what you ask. And I will explain this on the next couple of slides. But that's really quite important that you are able to do that. Okay, so much for the introduction. So, if there are not any questions at the moment, but anyway, if there are any questions, then just ask immediately. Then I will just start now with the technical part. As I said, firstly, one could try to think about what this kind of UMA extension, which I'm presenting here, the UMA tech extension, what this is supposed to satisfy or to provide. The aim is to use it in the general software engineering context for secure systems. So you want basic security requirements, and these are some examples here, but as I said already, there are also other security requirements which should be covered, and I will also mention that on the next couple of slides. Then you want different adversary models. I just mentioned that also on that question, but not only with respect to the things that are the role of the adversary, but also with respect to the strength of the adversary. So you could, even if you just worry about external adversaries, it makes a difference whether you worry about like the usual hacker who tries to break into a web server in order to deface a website, or if you worry about military-grade adversaries who can buy dedicated hardware to crack encryption keys and so on. And of course, this is a huge difference, and you also have to take this into consideration if you want to analyze a system specification for possible security flaws. So this should also be possible in the context of this UML extension. And it should also be possible to include in the UML model important security concepts such as tamper-resistant hardware and also specific security mechanisms such as access control and so on. And of course, you need to be able to express or to use in the UML model the basic primitives such as cryptographic algorithms. And another thing which we have to consider the security requirements relative to is the level of physical security. So it really also not only depends on the adversary model, but also on the physical foundation of the system, whether a system will be secure. So whether a certain communication link is an internet link, or whether it's a wireless link, and so on, or whether it's a local area network. So these things make a very big difference, and therefore it's not possible to make a security analysis in this kind of sense, which I mean here, without being able to actually express this kind of information in this new main model. And another thing which is important in security is that mainly security flaws actually arise on the boundary between the system itself and the human users. So it would be important also to be able to address things like secure workflow, be able to specify how the system is supposed to be used by the human user, and to check that if it's used in that way, then it will be secure, and also to check what happens if it's used in a different way. So the problem again with security is that you really have to worry about all kinds of levels of the system, all viewpoints, and it's very much important to worry about the boundaries between different system levels and the boundaries between different viewpoints, because this is really where the attacks usually are directed, because this is usually what people don't worry about. So they just, you know, they look at the cryptographic algorithms which they use, and they say, okay, I'm using a key with 128 bits, then therefore this is going to be secure, and then I'm happy. But they don't, again, they don't worry about how the cryptography is actually used in the system context, as I pointed out earlier. And it would be nice also, because there are many domain-specific concepts with sophisticated security mechanisms, that you would also be able to analyze the secure use of this context in of the system's mechanisms in this context, such as Java security and so on. Okay, so these are quite a lot of requirements, and so let's see how far one can get towards that. So now I would like to explain a couple of extension mechanisms, or a couple of stereotypes, which were defined in order to formalize security requirements so you can include them into UML modules. And I will start, I will sort of try to follow the usual path in system development, where you may start with use case diagrams, which you use firstly to to write down the requirements on the system which is going to be developed. So also in this security concept context, you also do that, and now more specifically with respect to security requirements. So one security requirement, if you look at this example, there you have what is supposed to be a sales application between a customer and a business. The customer is supposed to buy something from the business, and the security requirement there is just very abstractly that this transaction should be performed in a fair way, which means that neither the customer nor the business is able to cheat the other transaction partner. And you want to be able to firstly write this down in the diagram, because you want to, you know, for documentation purposes, you want everyone to be aware of the fact that this is important here, and that they have to worry about it, you know, the implementers and the designers and so on. But of course, this is nice if you can just write this down as this kind of stereotype. But the second thing you want is a little bit more than that. You actually also want to be able to analyze that the system design, the system specification actually fulfills this requirement, at least on the level of the design model. And for that, of course, you cannot really determine this on the level of a use case diagram, because there's really not a lot of information in there. This only says, okay, the customer and the business do some transaction, but you don't know how this is going to be done, so you don't know if it's going to be secure. Therefore, you can, in order to establish that, you can go to the next kind of UML diagram. And what you could do in general, not just in security, you could try to define these use cases in more detail using activity diagrams, for example. So here again, we have customer and the business, which are supposed to perform the two use cases. But now this, the use case of the customer is defined in more detail. So in order to buy something, the customer has to request the goods, has to pay for the goods in front, which is what we assume in this example. And then either the customer waits until the delivery is supposed to be due, the goods is supposed to be delivered, and then either this is actually happens, then the customer picks up the goods, or it does not happen, and then at least this specification requires that then the customer should be able to reclaim the money. The question is now whether this specification of this kind of business process is actually secure with respect to this pay exchange requirement. And in order to be able to analyze this using automated tools, we now make use of the fact that in UML with these kind of stereotypes, which are itself only labels written in these double angle brackets, you can actually have associated more information. So it's not just a label, but you can associate additional information first using so-called tag values, which are tag value pairs. In this example, the fact change stereotype has two tag value pairs, namely the tag start, which in this case has the value K, which is one of the activity states in the activity diagram, and secondly the tag stop, which has as value two states in the activity diagram, namely reclaim and pick up. So firstly you can have tags associated with stereotypes, but secondly you can also have constraints associated, and these constraints then have to be fulfilled in order for the diagram to correctly be marked with the stereotype pair exchange. In this case, the constraint which has to be fulfilled is simply that for every complete execution of the specification, if the execution at some point contains the pay state, then eventually one of the stop state states should be reached. And if you use this, if you just make correct usage of this kind of mechanism and of the fact change stereotype, then this actually results in a secure fair exchange system. Because the idea is that in this example, this means that the start state is pay. This means whenever the customer pays for a good, then eventually he will be able to pick up the good in this state here, or will at least be able to reclaim the money. And then we would say that this is a fair transaction, because the customer cannot cheat the business, because the customer has to pay the front anyway. But the business can also not cheat the customer, because either the customer gets the good or the customer is able to reclaim the money. So this is of course a very simple example, it's a bit simplified in the practical situation, but to show how this kind of fair exchange stereotype can be used in this context. that was the sort of the motivating example there. And as I explained already, what we did then in the context of this UML tag extension, the goal was to ensure this condition. What we did was to define this constraint, and in order to have automated tool support to actually verify the constraint, we have to define the constraint in a formal way, because you have to code the checker up in a tool, and of course the tool has to know in a precise way what the constraint is going to be. And in fact, I will say a little bit about tool support later. What we used here was a tool binding of a UML tails tool to a model checker. And so in this case, we had to define this fair exchange condition in the input language of the model checker, such as temporal logic. But the point is again that This has to be done only once and for all by the developers of the UMNSSEC extension, which is us, and then the users of the UMNSSEC extension, they don't have to do this again. And they don't actually have to be required to understand how this works exactly in the formal details, but they only have to understand this, the stereotype and understand the way in which they would use the stereotype, and then the tool will automatically verify that this is actually fulfilled. Yeah, and in this example, this is actually fulfilled, as I explained already, because the customer has the two options, either to pick up the goods or to retain the money. So this is the first kind of stereotype. And then, now for other kinds of stereotypes, well, this is going back to a remark I made earlier, that it's important to worry about the physical context of the software system, and this includes information such as which kind of communication link is going to be an internet link, and so on. And therefore, we'd also like to be able to include this information in the UML model, and to do this using other kinds of stereotypes, such as the internet stereotype. If you put this into a deployment diagram, for example, so if you do this kind of diagram, this is used in order to specify the physical architecture of the system. So here you have different nodes, which are written as these boxes, which may be connected by communication links, and you may have components residing on the nodes, which may be connected by logical communication links. So if you want to be able to specify the physical security characteristics, this means that in this kind of diagram, you want to be able to specify this, that, for example, this communication link is in fact an internet link, because this is going to be important for the security analysis. So, of course, it could be other things. It could be an encrypted internet link, such as a virtual private network, or it could be a local area network link, and, or it could be a protected component, such as a smart card node, and things like that. So you can mark nodes and links with these kind of stereotypes. And now, this comes back to the earlier question, how do you differentiate between different kinds of adversaries? And this actually, this is the first kind of the first part, how you do this. Namely, firstly, you have to decide which kind of adversary you worry about in the first place. And this is the sort of the so-called adversary type. And this could be, in this example here, the default adversary, who is external. Who is external to the system, he's not an internal user, and who has like modest capabilities, so who is able to attack an internet link by reading information that is exchanged over the link, and by inserting messages into the internet link, and by modifying the messages. And this is now on the level of the underlying analysis foundation of the approach. This is captured by these so-called threat sets, and these are also defined as part of the UMNSSEC extension. So, in the case of the internet link, the default adversary is able to delete, read, and insert messages on the communication link. And this is the adversary model, which is defined in this way by the people who define the UMNSSEC extension. And in the case of an encrypted internet link, it's only possible to delete the information and not possible to read or insert messages on the link. And in the case of a local area network, an external adversary would not be able to actually even delete the messages at all. Similarly, in the case of a smart card, you would assume that a modest adversary would not be able to attack a smart card. So, yeah, it's possible to define different kinds of adversary model in this way, using the threats which arise from different kinds of adversaries with respect to different kinds of physical parts of the system. So this is just to include more information, more security relevant information in the UMA model. Now the next kind of stereotype now makes use of this information in order to establish that the architecture which you define for the system is actually secure on the architecture level. And this is another aspect of the system. So to recall, we already considered the use case view of the system, and we looked at business processes, and now we get down to the actual software architecture of the system. And this again also has to be secure, and one of the aspects that are important here are, as I just mentioned, the physical level of the system. So now the question is, how can we establish that the software architecture of the system is secure if compared to the physical infrastructure of the system? And this is sort of the challenge we have to worry about now, and for which we now want to define a stereotype. So in this example, again, we have this we have two components which are connected by an internet link, and we have the communication between the two components should satisfy secrecy. So the information which is going to be exchanged should remain secret, and we want to be able to now be able to analyze whether this is a good architectural specification with respect to a given adversary model. So firstly, the question is, how can we do this? Again, as the developers of the UMA SEC extension, we had to worry about what to do in order to be able to do that. So what we want to do is to define a stereotype called secure links, which makes sure that the underlying physical layer actually is adequate for the requirements that are imposed on the communication. And again, we had to define a precise constraint in order to be able to implement that in a tool which then automatically analyzes the constraint. And the constraint is now for each dependency in the deployment diagram, which carries one of these security requirements, such as secrecy, integrity, authenticity, and so on. So again, on all of the next slides, I will usually only mention secrecy and integrity, but I will usually also this implies that this should also work for other security requirements. So, but I only mention these two because of, you know, to keep things simple, because these are the two most simple security requirements. So anyway, whenever you have security requirements on the dependency between two components on different nodes, then the communication link, which is supposed to support this communication dependency, this should actually respect the security requirements with respect to the adversary model. Now, going back to the examples, what we have to consider here is whether this communication remains secret with given the fact that this is supposed to be exchanged over an internet link. And now, again, of course, we have to define or to consider which kind of adversary model we worry about. So assume that we worry about the deployed adversary. Now the question is, firstly, is this a secure design? And secondly, can we automatically verify this using our tools? And well, the first question, I mean, if you know a little bit about security, are there any opinions about whether this, as it's written here, is actually a secure design of the system? So maybe I should go back to what I said here, namely, the realistic assumption is, in fact, that the usual default adversary is able to read a communication which is changed over an internet link, because it's rather easy to do this with today's internet, because the internet is not designed to be secure, because it was not intended to be used as a commercial transaction channel. So in fact, we have this reach threat on internet links with respect to the default adversary, meaning that in fact this is not a secure design, because there are some plain communication exchanged here. It's just a plain communication link which is supposed to satisfy secrecy against the default adversary, but if it's an internet link, then this will not remain secret. So if the tool evaluates this constraint here, the result will be that in fact really constrained secure link is violated, because as I just said, the communication here on the internet link is not does not satisfy secrecy with respect to a default adversary. Of course, you could fix the problem by making use of cryptography in this context, but that's just, you know, that's a different problem now. The next problem would be how to securely make use of cryptography in this context. But the first point, the first step is simply to realize that this is, like that, it's not a secure design. And of course, this looks rather trivial here in this kind of very simple example, but in general, if you have a complicated architecture, then it may not be easy to see without tool support whether these kind of consistency checks are actually satisfied in the architecture design model. Okay, so this is a different kind of stereotype which allows you to check whether these basic kind of consistency checks are fulfilled in your architectural model. Now, the next kind of security requirement you would like to worry about maybe is whether if you now go down on the data structure of your system, whether the data structure is actually consistent with respect to security requirements. So firstly, so I guess I'm sort of in the middle of the presentation now. Maybe is there a need for a break here? Is anyone interested in a break? I don't actually mind, so whatever is preferred by people. Okay, yeah, just have a 5 minute. Yeah, just have a 5 minute break, and I will continue after the break with the next couple of stereotypes. And any questions at the moment?
Yeah,
okay.
I wonder if you use any formality for defining the security requirements at the use case diagram.
Yeah, at the use case diagram level, actually, no, because as here we only say, okay, it's a very abstract diagram which really does not contain a lot of information. It just says, okay, the customer is supposed to buy wood from the business, which is supposed to sell the wood, and that's really all. It is all information. So I we thought about whether you could already do a security analysis here, but we couldn't really find out how to do this. I mean, you would really have to extend the diagram with additional information. You could try to do this using OCA constraints, for example, and then if you do that, you can actually verify these constraints. But for the moment, we just decided to leave the diagram as it is and just say, okay, you can already include the requirement there in order to remember that you want this requirement. And if you then go to the activity diagram to provide more detail on the use cases, and then this stereotype also has to be included here, and then you can actually analyze the specification, because here you actually have more information which you can actually analyze.
So you use the
activity diagram to specify, for example, the business process, like the business process here, and you can include security requirements using the stereotype up there, and also using the tags which are associated, and then you can use the activity diagram with the included security requirements, to analyze using the tool, analyze automatically that this business process satisfies the security requirement using the tool as a serial type.
Okay, thank you. Then we'll continue in 5 minutes.